This is a special recording of Taste Matters, part of a series in conjunction with the opening of the Next World's Fair, Expo Milano 2015, where the U.S. will be participating with the USA Pavilion, themed American Food 2.0, United to Feed the Planet.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And it's been some time, but on Wednesdays at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about taste. We've been on hiatus for a while, in part because of the topic of today's show and the subsequent shows. We're going to be doing a series based on the upcoming World's Fair in Milan. Yes, you heard that right. There are still World's Fairs, and the next one will be in Milan in 2015. It's called Expo Milano 2015, appropriately enough. And the theme of the show and the reason that it's occupied much of my time, so much so that I have been unable to maintain a consistent weekly radio show, is food. In fact, the theme is feeding the planet, energy for life. And all of the participating countries, including the United States, there are 147 in total, are producing pavilions based on this concept of how we will feed the world, the 9 billion people who will inhabit the Earth, by 2050. That's not that far away. It's a lot of people. Estimates are we're near 7 billion now. And the question of how each country will participate, how the world will deal with an influx of people, whether or not that's even a challenge. Some people think that there's plenty of food right now, and we just have to figure out how to distribute it better. But every one of the participating countries and organizations is going to address that issue. And that includes the United States of America. And as part of a collaboration between the James Beard Foundation and the International Culinary Center, we have created an organization that is producing the American Pavilion. We're calling it American Food 2.0. And we're in the next series of episodes, about eight, I think, of Taste Matters, we are going to be having conversations with various people involved in the current project of building the American Pavilion at the next World's Fair, but also in World's Fairs in general. Food has always been an important part of World's Fairs, even though they have not all, none has been themed food overall until the Italian fair next year. And so to start us off on this journey to Milan, we have with us in the studio someone who has been here, a guest on the show before, James Bieber, who is an architect at Bieber Architects. I wonder where they got the name for that. I just heard an explosion, I think, on the radio. Jim Bieber has designed and is currently in the process of building the American Pavilion at the World's Fair. So first of all, Jim, welcome back to Roberta's and welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thanks.
And I want to start, before we get into what your vision for the American Pavilion this time around, I really want to situate us in World's Fairs of the past. I mean, from the beginning, and the role that architecture and the role that a vision of the future of space and the way that people participate in society has always been a part of those fairs.
So, you know, the first, we weren't around, but the first World's Fair, though it didn't know it was going to be the first World's Fair, was in London in 1851. It was the Crystal Palace, was a bespoke building built by Joseph Paxton, a greenhouse designer. The largest covered space in the world, maybe the most remarkable building, industrialized building up to that point, prefabricated, cast iron and steel, designed, fabricated, and erected in 9 months, and covered something like 14,000 exhibits. And,
wow.
And because it was the late industrial revolution, it really was the brand new world. It was steam powered everything, and it was motorized carts that took people above the fair back and forth, kind of their early mono, maybe duo rail at that point. Just kind of an extravaganza captured in lithographs of the next world to come. And you know, that sort of set the pace. It was then moved to another site in London. It was in Hyde Park originally. Yep. Ultimately burned down. I could never figure out how glass and steel buildings burned down, but it did.
Right.
And but it set the stage for these you know, kind of bi-decade or semi-decade long, you know, events that have, that include the Eiffel Tower as the kind of vertical event of the Paris Fair, and ultimately to New York in 1939 when the Trilon and Paris Fair, you know, another kind of roundy, right, roundy and tally thing, kind of dominates the center of the fair. It they have a tradition of being all about the future, and they became. And they started, I think, as kind of commercial fairs. They were, in fact, industrial fairs, much more than national fairs, but they sort of evolved into national fairs. And, you know, as recently as 1939, they had a kind of an interesting mix of commercial and national interests.
So, and by commercial, you mean literally like businesses, corporations,
largest
building,
corporations,
right,
in the world. Largest, right. I mean, and they've always included the largest corporations, the newest technology, the latest innovations, including things like, I remember from 1964, the picture phone, which, you know, has finally made it into, right, our pockets about 50 years later. But, you know, that's kind of, so not always successful, but color television at in 64, television
elevators,
in 1939,
I've heard,
elevators, yeah. Otis had this amazing, in New York in 98, I think, he demonstrated the elevator. Of course, elevators already existed at that point, but what he demonstrated was he cut the rope while lifted on the platform, and the safety brake, you know, to the gas of the crowd, the safety brake stopped it. And that was actually the thing that made elevators possible for most people to go in and not be afraid they were going to plunge to their deaths.
Fascinating. Interestingly, the history has been overseen by the same body since London, my understanding. It's like the Olympic Committee, the Bureau Internationale des Expositions.
Exactly.
Right? Continues to be the people that we're working with on this project.
Right.
Right? And this orientation towards the future remains important. Obviously, the combination of commerce and business. But today, when everyone, you know, when you have your video phone in your pocket and you can see the world on your Twitter feed, like from the perspective of someone who builds things, creates environments, what's the role of a World's Fair today?
Well, you know, it is harder. I think you're right. You're alluding to the fact that it's harder now to amaze people. Movies do it probably more than anything,
right,
else. But, you know, we're already bored by the fact that Minority Report hasn't kind of come true. So,
right,
so it's very hard to build these things. The Crystal Palace really did amaze people. It was a stunning thing. And I think as late as 1967, when Buckminster Fuller built this incredible kind of transparent bubble around a rather ordinary building for the U.S. Pavilion, I think that architecture continued to amaze people, maybe even to Osaka with the inflatable U.S. Pavilion. These became the kind of national, and actually, as a sort of side note, the kitchen debates and the American exposition in Moscow, and I think it was 1958, was another kind of Cold War artifact and a way of battling without battling. So just like the Olympics, they became kind of battle, you know, wars fought quietly,
right,
on World's Fair grounds. And it's still the case. Every nation comes out and tries to outdo the other. You know, it'll be very interesting to see. We're next to Switzerland, Germany, Russia's not too far away, Kuwait's right next to us. It'll be very interesting to see how the neighborhood shapes up. You know? And they really do become kind of neighborhoods,
right,
of usually object-like buildings. And this fair is really unusual in the fact that it's very urban. It has all the sites are very long and thin. People from Manhattan will feel right at home. It's
right,
going to be one long Fifth Avenue of national pavilions.
I should remind people listening that you can go see some of the plans that we'll get into more detail, but also a plan of the whole park at our website, usapavilion2015.net. That doesn't just roll off the tongue, but USA Pavilion, only one Ellen Pavilion, 2015.net. So let's talk about your approach, I mean, from the beginning to the American Pavilion. Obviously, we're talking about America today. The subject is food, and not just food culture, but food security, a sort of global perspective on the food system. And also, you know, we are coming to the fair with some unique limitations from the American perspective, which we could get into maybe later. But so what you know, when we first sat down and brainstormed about this idea, what went through your mind and what did you think that the American Pavilion ought to be today?
Well, you know, this is a really daunting task because, you know, our client is actually the State Department. They may have a slightly different perspective on America than the rest of us. And so, you know, we tried to take we did a couple of things. We looked back and looked at what had been done recently. And without pointing fingers, I think that there's been a kind of decline in the quality and the content of the U.S. Pavilion over the last few years, many attribute it to the new way in which it's funded, funded privately, not by the U.S. government, and much more influenced by corporate presence. And so these exhibitions, for all sorts of reasons, and especially the U.S. Pavilion, has become a kind of closed, opaque box, usually rather funny shaped box. One door in, a couple of theaters, maybe a trade show. Gift shop, exit through the gift shop, and you're out. And, these are very media-driven. They're not social events. They're really kind of in the dark. And that never seemed to us to be the way to talk about food.
No, although kind of perhaps representative of American architecture in general, you might say. You just described six movie theaters and a mall,
exactly,
I think, right?
Exactly. Well, and so it's a culturally appropriate.
Right.
But these things are supposed to be aspirational, and they're supposed to be to represent the best of America, or the our view of the best of America. And so we took a very very optimistic view that America is, in fact, an open society, a transparent society, a socially mobile society, and created a pavilion that in one shot, in one instant view, can be completely understood. So it's a completely open pavilion as opposed to a closed pavilion. It lays out as a kind of promenade through an experience, this what we call the boardwalk, and mostly because it's actually salvaged timber from the Coney Island boardwalk, leads you up and down through this kind of, panorama of food and food issues. There are other exhibits, and there are, rooftop social spaces and flexible spaces, but in fact, all these things are laid out pretty much at a view. And it's also a building that we wanted to talk about science and nature, the kind of, not the division so much between science and nature, but the fact that, in fact, they are very much, biology is technology as a kind of mm-hmm. metaphor. And so we looked at ways of positing nature as science and science a bit as kind of nature, and tried to make a conversation, or at least a debate, out of the building.
So let's get specific about that. How do you do something like that in a building? I say that because I think most people think of buildings as structures that hold things rather than structures that say things or do things.
Well, that's fair enough. And I feel like I do feel in the team, I'm really the form guy more than the content guy. And really, Think has been working on a fantastic exhibit. And for most people, I think the explicit content will come from their exhibit. But of course, buildings are big signs. Buildings are a kind of language. And so what they say and what language they speak in affects people, even if it's a little bit subconscious. And so, one very obvious piece of our building is this gigantic football field length vertical farm. So we didn't have room for a horizontal farm, so we tipped it vertically and made a landscape that runs vertically down the side of the building. That sounds like a kind of, that could be a big decorative event, and it could just be a lot of, a lot of kind of nature decorating the side of the building. But in fact, it's a technological feat, growing it hydroponically, having the panels move so they track the sun, how they're harvested, how they're fed. This is a real sort of technological feat, and so is farming, frankly.
Right. Right. So there in one place is technology and biology together,
right.
On a wall.
And even on the roof, where we have a roof terrace, so the there is a height limit to the buildings at the fair, and we've gone right up against that height limit by putting a roof terrace at the very highest point so you can kind of enjoy the fair, the view over the fair. It's shaded by switchable glass that can go from transparent glass to opaque glass pretty much at the flip of a switch. And so it's a way in which we're avoiding air conditioning, lots of air conditioning. We do have misting as a way of cooling. Mm-hmm. So we're naturally kind of cooling the space. So we're creating kind of a beautiful outdoor garden that might be a shaded space out in nature, but doing it with technology, doing it with switchable glass, with misting instead of fog, and creating a kind of an environment that mimics, it's a little bit of biomimicry about how it operates. Mm.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. I'm talking with James Bieber, the architect of the American Pavilion at the next World's Fair in Milan in 2015. You're listening to Taste Matters. Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and I'm talking with James Bieber, the architect of the American Pavilion at the Next World's Fair, Expo Milano 2015. You can visit our website for the World's Fair, or well, you can link from actually Taste Matters' website, but the World's Fair is usapavilion2015.net, where you'll see renderings of the building. And if you follow us on our Twitter feed, which is USA Expo 2015, you can see updated photographs from the site at the World's Fair in Milan as the building is going up. As we get those pictures, as things happen. I say that smiling because we just got pictures last night of the verticality of the building. Let's talk about how you build a building within a place that's being built by 147 other countries at the same time, and like what the logistics of that, or the nightmare of that might be.
And in Italy.
While we're fundraising.
While we're fundraising. And while, you know, Italy is and the fair are being kind of racked by pretty much periodic scandals. And so it's a – I think it's actually poised to be the Italian miracle. I think this is all a very clever setup. You know, Italians know that they can do this. They know that they can pull this out. And right now, from what was a kind of flat site, buildings are blooming. It's amazing how quickly buildings are becoming vertical.
So where is it located?
It's outside of Milan. And if anybody's been to the Salone di Mobile – there's a fiera. There's a new fair grounds called Fiera, and it's adjacent to that. So it's at the end of the last subway line at Row, and so easy. You know, what is it? 20 or 25 minutes from the from the center, and it's a vast site with literally hundreds of buildings from scratch, from essentially farmland.
Wow. Okay, and in the middle of that, next to Kuwait and Germany, the American Pavilion rises.
Finally.
So let's walk people through the process.
So I think there's a really good reason that nobody ever does two of these. You know that I don't know anybody who's designed more than a pavilion, because most of them are. Actually, I do know, but no one's ever done two. And
right.
So the process now is really very, very trying, because we are at the same time, and you know this full well, Mitchell, since you kind of got us all into this, you know, we're raising money at the same time we're building. Unfortunately, what you really need for a building is a lot of money in the beginning.
Right.
And, you know, it can kind of taper off. We get money in exactly the opposite order. And so the challenge of building something and waiting till we have the money and actually proceeding at the right pace, and it's a kind of upside down building, but it does seem to work. It's worked so far, and we are finally out of the ground and have vertical steel, and so it's starting to feel real and exciting, and you know, kind of like we're actually making something other than drawings.
Right. Who is doing the actual building?
There's a company called Neusley. They build. They have two businesses. They build at World's Fairs and they build at Olympics. So all temporary buildings.
Really?
And we should also talk about the fact that this is a fair whose theme is food, with a very strong sort of sustainability strain.
Right.
And that is kind of oxymoronic in a fair that the BIE requires all of the pavilions to be removed in 6 months, after the fair is over. Now, the reason that the two fairs in New York were not considered class one expos is because Robert Moses said that's absolutely ridiculous. I'm having the fair for 2 years, and so you know they were different, and they were therefore you know they didn't play by the same rules. But a class one expo or a grade one expo, I forget, is required to remove all the pavilions except I think the National Pavilion and one or two other things. So this site will return to you know bare infrastructure,
which is inherently not the most sustainable.
I would say so. So and you know it is very difficult to embrace the idea of sustainability while knowing that everything we do is going to disappear in 6 months.
What about Habitat in Expo 67, which Moshe Zafdi is building, which I just happened to see a model of because he designed the new Crystal Bridges Museum?
That's very interesting, actually, because the U.S. Pavilion actually does sit does still exist at Expo 67 in Montreal. The dome is the glazing is all gone, but it's really still there.
So maybe the Canadians asked for some exceptionalism, like their American neighbors, right?
You know, who can explain Canada?
Maybe you. Okay, so I want people listening to have a better idea of when they come, because I expect everyone listening to come to Milan and to see this fair. Because people listening, actually, this is a good audience. If you're interested in Heritage Radio and in the role that heritage foods, that cultural traditions play in food and in the future of food, certainly, then you might want to find yourself in Milan. You have 6 months to get there from May 1 to October 31st. But let's walk us through the building.
And 6 months from today, I think, is the day you should be there if you want to be at the opening.
Oh, my God. My heart just stopped for a second.
It's a really frightening thing. I woke up this morning thinking – What exactly are we going to do in 6 months? And it all comes to an end. It's like a Broadway show. You know, it opens.
Right.
It's
regardless.
It opens. It opens. You know, as Lorne Michaels said, we don't go on when we're ready. We go on when it's 11:30. You know, it's that's what's going to happen. It will open. And so, you know, all of a sudden, you know, your job will get much harder.
Yes.
My job will get much easier. And you know, I'm going to be there just to enjoy it.
Right.
Unlike you.
I'll be there. Right. Terrified, running around trying to put out fires. Not literal fires. Yeah. So walk us through. I want people to have a three-dimensional vision of what happens when they get off the main drag of the Expo, the Decumanus, and they walk up the boardwalk into the building.
So when you look at the building, you're going to see from the end of the building an entirely open frame. It was based on, in some way, kind of farm buildings that are built in bays and are actually quite repetitive open and, you know, very simple construction, mm-hmm. very explicit construction. So you'll see this ramp, this wooden ramp, rising up into this very large open space. And the open space is filled with fantastic exhibits. And
we'll talk about that. They'll be on the show later.
Exactly. So they can talk about those. But so you'll be able to rise up into the space and spend some time in the space in a kind of very big social mixer. You know, it's a large open space. The footprint of the building is around 10,000 square feet. And so these are big floors, and there really are only three of them. Hmm. This big boardwalk space, which is open to the air, cooled in a kind of very clever way because you can't cool the outdoors, shaded by the vertical farm, and a kind of really dynamic space that everyone can see and everyone, I think, is going to want to get into. It's going to be an instant magnet. You can go down the back of the boardwalk and continue on to the next exhibit, continue on to the next pavilion, or to Food Truck Nation just up the way.
So right, we're also operating a food truck park, right in true Brooklyn sensibility.
So you'll be able to see that, but there's another layer that you can take, and you can then wait on a small queue in the back under shaded under trees and go through a real exhibit. I should say, you know, a very carefully programmed, fantastically developed set of meals, you know, uh-huh. American meals. And further, there's a kind of a big flex space. You know, Italians love coffee in the morning. They love to inhabit rooftops and kind of look out. And so there's a space on the top, the roof terrace, that is, you know, a cocktail lab, a place to get coffee, a place for events, and so on. And there's an escalator that can take you up and back down. All of the transportation through the building is through this one zone that is kind of transparent, and you'll see people going up and down and elevators going up and down. And it's a bit of a machine. The whole pavilion is a bit of a kind of farm machine, including the long facade that is constantly moving slightly, like, you know, breathing or like gills, so that the panels are kind of slowly adjusting themselves to
the
green panel. Right, exactly. And unlike a lot, there will be a lot of green walls at the fair. Ours is not a decorative green wall. It's literally a farm. We're growing produce. It's going to be harvested continuously, kind of in front of people by people hanging on ropes and harvesting. We'll have a nursery where these things are all germinated and traded out at night. There'll be similar things on the inside of the boardwalk area, kind of growing living chandeliers. And so it's a building that is literally acting like a kind of farm machine.
You mentioned there are other growing walls. I imagine you are aware of some of the other pavilions going up. Any that interest you or that you think are cool or that you think are stupid? Or
all of the above. And, you know, what's really interesting to me is that you don't know by looking at the designs we've seen so far what the favorite pavilion really is going to be. For instance, Norman Foster, who I think is an extraordinary architect, has designed something that for most people is pretty opaque. They just don't get why this is a great thing. I'm convinced that it will be way more interesting.
Whose building is that?
That is United Arab Emirates.
Oh.
The New Holland, you know, Fiat Chrysler's farm machine division, is building a building with a tipped field. Ours is vertical, theirs is tipped, and covered with robotic tractors drawing things in the dirt. So it will be a kind of constant etch-a-sketch, gigantic tipped etch-a-sketch, which I think will be fantastic. I think it's IKEA and or one of the large food, it's not Sainsbury's, but anyway, there's a large kind of grocery of the future that's happening and a store of the future.
I think it's Tesco.
Tesco, I think you're absolutely right. And there are lots of environmental pavilions that frankly, you just won't know they're fantastic until you're inside.
Actually, when I was at Roberta's not a few weeks ago with Carlo Petrini and Alice Waters celebrating the 25th anniversary, they were talking, Slow Food was originally involved, and then they fell out of favor because they didn't like the direction, the corporate direction it was going, and then the new management of Expo brought them back in, and instead of a pavilion, Carlo Petrini was telling me they're building a mound. they're going to have a mound of dirt in the middle somewhere on a plot of land.
Well, given the kind of construction issues at the fair, I understand why that's such an attractive idea. We have a mound, but it's
but we have to move it and bring it back.
We have to move it exactly. There's a lot of dirt being moved around. There's a lot of that. You know, there's a lot of dirt. So if we had been smart, and in fact, you know, the original, it's interesting, the original design for the fair had no permanent buildings. It was an acknowledgement that, you know, this is really a very, very large use of resources. And the original plan by Herzog and de Meuron had tented pavilion areas. So everything was kind of open air and light as possible. And although the plan of the fair was maintained, that idea wasn't. And I think that was really an impossible thing for nations to accept, that all of them would be under tents, that everything would be kind of lightweight and more like a bazaar than like a World's Fair, because these World's Fairs have really become battlegrounds for design.
Right. And there are other international exhibits that happen, or expos that happen, for lack of another word, that America participates in and builds things. Are there not? Like, I'm thinking the Venice Biennale.
Oh, okay. So the thing that's, you know, for a while, because nobody really knows that there's an expo in Milan. I mean, until now, of course.
Right. Everyone knows.
But there was, and there is going on right now, the Architecture Biennale. Every, you know, it alternates art, architecture. And so until the 23rd or so of November, that's open. And when I went to that, and I told people I was building the American Pavilion, they were incredibly confused, and everybody assumed it was the pavilion. I was doing the pavilion, which actually Storefront for Architecture is doing at the Biennale. That pavilion is permanent and sits in the Giardini with other national pavilions, and including some nations that don't exist anymore, lots of nations that don't exist anymore, and some very famous architects. You know, Aalto built the Finland Pavilion, and there's some quite fantastic buildings. Not, unfortunately, the U.S. Pavilion. It's a kind of Monticello-esque thing. And then there's a large Arsenale, which is a big kind of, which is a rope, an old rope factory. It's like a quarter mile long. And that's a large kind of combined fair. And Rem Koolhaas did the one this year, and it's quite fantastic and very controversial.
Oh, of course. So in the last few minutes we have, I would want to ask you, if the theme of this expo were architecture, or if a future expo's theme were architecture instead of food, what would America's contribution be, or where do you think we are going, or what's our role?
You know, that it's interesting, because I think that the Biennale answers that in the eyes of Rem Koolhaas to some degree. I mean, what he's done in this fair called Fundamentals is to kind of take apart architecture not as a kind of heroic act, but actually as an assembly of rather mundane and kind of somewhat evolved pieces. And so he's made it a catalog, a three-dimensional catalog of, and in some sense, that way of building is what America has brought to the world. The American Pavilion at the Architecture Biennale has hundreds of portfolios of buildings that America has built elsewhere, because this was part of the part of the theme developed. And what's so interesting about it is, I think it is intended as a kind of modest way to explain, you know, all these different firms, be very democratic about the kind of the reach of firms. In the end, it looks to me, and I apologize for being critical, but it looks to me like design imperialism, and that actually what America has exported is some fairly difficult architectural ideas that have really influenced the world, and not all for the better.
I need an example.
Well, you know, for example, you know, the idea of modern towers starting with the Seagram Building in New York, and this fantastic curtain wall of bronze by Mies van der Rohe has eventually become aluminum curtain walls, ubiquitous all around the world. And so what were once kind of bespoke and really carefully considered are now manufactured and, frankly, value engineered to their lowest common denominator. And I think that's a lot of what architects have spent a lot of time buying and assembling things from catalogs rather than designing things. And I think that methodology is unfortunately part of the U.S. legacy.
Well, it won't be part of the legacy of the American Pavilion at Expo Milano.
Fortunately or unfortunately not. The builders aren't very happy about that, but we are. Right?
But it will be unique and a unique contribution. And we thank you for joining us, and also for taking on this massive project of nightmares and challenges, and hopefully some very rewarding moments when we give the world something they don't expect to come, really, from America about food or architecture or all the other great things that are going to be inside of it.
It's all been fun.
We will continue this conversation in future episodes of Taste Matters about the American Pavilion at Expo Milano. You can look forward to speaking with Tom Hennis and the team at Think, who will be doing the exhibits inside, as well as some of the folks responsible for the actual food that will be served, and all of the other components, as well as some historical elements. I was fortunate to participate in a Smithsonian workshop on World's Fair since 1964. I missed the one before 1964, but there's so much out there, so much richness in the World's Fairs that I think, for some reason, I feel like we may be far enough away from them for the nostalgia to turn into something actually a little bit more concrete and going forward a little bit more focus and attention here in the United States. At least that's our hope for all the people working on this project. Thanks for listening to Taste Matters. We'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.